I next met with Dr. John Haymack, and to begin, I asked him to comment on his experience working on the Cancer Genome Atlas Consortium.
The Cancer Genome Atlas, the TCGA, is a consortium, mainly in the United States, it does include some ex-US sites, to try to characterize different cancers at a genomic level, not only at a genomic level, but also at a protein level, at a transcriptome level. So what they've said, and I think this is a very wise idea, is instead of having independent efforts where one group is very good at profiling mRNA, another group is good at profiling mutations, to take a common set of tumors that are very well characterized and have the best groups come together and profile this common set of tumors as thoroughly as possible. So now the TCGA consortium is really starting to produce wonderful results. You can think of this as the catalog for all the alterations in cancers. Now in lung cancer, they picked squamous cell carcinoma as the first one to characterize in detail. And I think this was a good choice because there's a lot of work already on adenocarcinoma. We already know a lot of the mutations in adenocarcinoma. By the way, the adenocarcinoma TCGA project, the publication is going to be submitted shortly for that. So that's coming out this year. But the squamous cell carcinoma went first. And as I said, I think that was where the initial work was needed.
Maybe getting back more towards, you know, the present. I mean, that looks like an exciting thing for the future. But in terms of present, anything new in terms of using the tools that we have right now for squamous cell, particularly advanced squamous cell? You know, one thing I asked you about in the past is this issue. You know, we now have nab-paclitaxel approved in lung cancer. And I'm curious, you know, there have been thoughts that maybe it's more active in squamous cell. You've had some thoughts about that. Where are we today with nab and our understanding of chemo and squamous cell?
Well, nab-paclitaxel, I think, is a very interesting example. There were some preclinical suggestions that this could be more active in squamous cell carcinoma, and this has to do with the fact that the receptor that helps take up nab-paclitaxel that combined to albumin seems to be higher expressed in squamous cell carcinoma. And this was confirmed in the trial by Mark Sosinski, where the response rate was significantly higher in squamous cell carcinoma than the response rate was to just conventional paclitaxel. So that confirmed it. Although the overall survival, which wasn't the primary endpoint of the study, wasn't significantly longer, but it did look like it was more active. And we know the drug may be better tolerated in some ways than conventional paclitaxel. So on our side, it is starting to get used. I'll often use it when I'm concerned about neuropathy or other toxicity in squamous cell carcinoma. There are issues that it's more expensive, of course, than regular paclitaxel, but we've started to use it in that front. And there is some additional science being developed around the receptors that take up nab-paclitaxel, which is paclitaxel bound to albumin, and some of the other proteins involved in that cascade that seem to be higher in squamous cell carcinoma. You know, I think at the end of the day, there is a possibility this drug could be combined with targeted agents. One of the issues is that in the clinical studies, it's used on a weekly basis instead of a once every 3 week basis, although there is a once every 3 week regimen that's out there. Now, this has advantages and disadvantages. It has an advantage that you can give lower doses and titrate doses more closely for people that have a poor performance status, so that's favorable, but it's obviously less convenient, especially if you have people traveling from the outside. So what we're trying to figure out is whether we can combine nab-paclitaxel on an every 3 week basis with targeted agents and whether that works as well as combining it with other things. So I think a key issue for nab-paclitaxel is whether it emerges as a backbone for combinations with targeted agents. We know with nab-paclitaxel with platinum by itself, it's not going to dramatically change outcomes in lung cancer as compared to standard chemotherapy, but it does have some advantages. And if it becomes the platform that people start combining targeted agents with, it's possible that it will really take off.
Yeah, of course, we've heard, you know, issues and discussions about NAB and breast cancer for a long time now. You know, and, you know, one of the things that I kind of been surprised at in breast cancer that, I mean, some people are into it and some people aren't, but is the issue of the lack of need for corticosteroids. And I was wondering about that at a couple of different levels. One, in terms of, you know, cost, of course, is an issue. But for example, I'm sure it's not uncommon to see patients in your practice who have coexistent diabetes. Mm-hmm. And is corticosteroids a concern for patients like that?
Yeah.
And the other thing is just sort of the you know, the impact, I don't know if there's enough corticosteroids. Could it in some way interfere with immune? You were talking about partnering it with agents. If you partner like with ipilimumab or whatever,
yeah,
would that be an issue? And I mean, I don't know if there are enough corticosteroids. You know, we hear, again, in prostate cancer, we've been hearing a lot about this, these lower doses of corticosteroids people get with the lyase inhibitors. I mean, any thoughts about all that stuff?
Yeah, those are all great questions. You know, the corticosteroids are, of course, a double-edged sword. Patients often feel better when they're on them. It reduces nausea. But of course, with a lot of our patients, especially with lung cancer, where many of them are insulin-dependent diabetics, sometimes it sends their blood sugars through the roof, and combine that with decreased intake around chemotherapy, and often you get dehydration. So I think in our diabetics, sometimes the use of corticosteroids is associated with complications around chemotherapy. And it's easy, unless you're really staying on top of monitoring blood sugars very closely during that period, it can cause problems. The flip side is there are cases where actually corticosteroids will make the patients feel better in terms of reducing edema and so forth. And if you're just giving it for a three-day course, you can usually get patients through that pretty easily. So I don't know if the use of corticosteroids is going to be a major driver, as things are right now, of shifting towards nab-paclitaxel, but it is a factor in favor of the drug. Now, the combinations with immune therapies is actually a really interesting question as well. And this is something that in designing these trials, we've discussed about taxane combinations and whether we should be giving the same dose of steroids or not. You know, I don't think we have any good answers to it, but as immune therapies start to become more commonly used, it's actually an important issue that hopefully somebody investigates systematically, because right now we're just guessing, to be honest, and we're trying to minimize steroid dosage around it, but we don't know if it's going to affect, for example, response to ipilimumab, the antibody against CTLA-4, or affect responses to PD-1 or PD-L1 antibodies. So those are all open questions, but all things being equal, you'd rather not use steroids if you didn't need to.
So I kind of want to get to your cases and talk about how we take care of patients today, but I still got to ask you a couple other things about sort of new agents and new strategies real briefly. One, MET inhibition and including the monoclonal antibody MetMab. What's up?
So MET is, I think, a very interesting target for lung cancer for a number of reasons. So sometimes MET is amplified. That happens often in tumors that have become resistant to EGFR inhibitors. One other interesting aspect of MET that I'd like to bring up, and this is work from a couple of groups, including ours with Jim Welsh, is after you radiate a tumor, they upregulate MET as well, even if it didn't express MET to start with. Now, MET is a factor that can not only drive resistance to EGFR inhibitors and other pathways, but it drives metastases. And that's really how it was initially characterized in different cancers, is its ability to induce cells to scatter and metastasize. So we have a few different agents targeting MET, the monoclonal antibody called MetMab. There are small molecule inhibitors like crizotinib and ARQ-197 that works by a different mechanism. MetMab is one that is pretty advanced in terms of the clinical testing with randomized studies. Now, in the initial randomized phase 2 study, it looked like the combination of MetMab and erlotinib in the subgroup of patients that expressed MET by either FISH or by protein using immunohistochemistry, that they had a significant benefit as compared to those that didn't express MET. So that's prompted a large phase 3 that's ongoing right now. Now, I should say that our enthusiasm in this area is tempered a little bit by the recent announcement by Arcule that their large phase 3 comparing the Arcule-197 drug plus erlotinib as compared to erlotinib didn't meet its primary endpoint there for the study. So it's a negative phase 3 study, although there may be subgroups there that do show a benefit. So we're going to have to wait and see, but that's a drug that works by a different mechanism. So MetMab is proceeding with their study, their phase 3 study, and we're eagerly awaiting results from this because it's clear that MET is a key player in resistance to EGFR inhibitors. We believe it may also be a mediator of resistance to angiogenesis inhibitors and other types of drugs as well. And to my mind, there's no question that targeting MET is going to be part of therapeutic strategies in the future. It's unlikely to be an active single agent by itself targeting MET, but it's clearly going to be something I think we're going to want to be combining with EGFR inhibitors and other types of agents in the future.
You know, that kind of leads also into the issue of EGFR TKIs and wild-type tumors and whether there's any role, because this kind of strategy of adding, you know, a MET inhibitor and like erlotinib, I guess, is based on the concept that somehow erlotinib might offer something in a wild-type tumor?
Yeah, no, it's a very interesting point because it's clear that the responses are much, much more dramatic in patients with EGFR mutations. You know, typically in studies of EGFR mutations, TKIs have between a 60 and an 80% objective response rate, whereas patients with wild-type EGFR are typically less than 5%, you know, in large studies. But nevertheless, there is a benefit in wild-type EGFR patients to EGFR inhibitors. And this is illustrated, for example, in the original BR21 study led by Francis Shepard and colleagues published in the New England Journal, where even squamous cell carcinoma, where EGFR mutations are not detected, squamous cell carcinoma benefited from erlotinib as compared to placebo. This has also been seen in erlotinib maintenance studies. Atlas and Saturn have been conducted, and there appears to be a benefit in squamous there as well, but it's much more moderate. So erlotinib is approved for the treatment of squamous cell carcinoma. The benefits appear to be more modest, but there is a benefit. I think you're much less likely to get tumor shrinkage, but there is a possibility of getting tumor stabilization. So I'll say that in my practice, I do use erlotinib in squamous cell carcinomas, but I go through the data with patients and say this is unlikely to cause a dramatic shrinkage, but there is a real hope that this will stabilize your tumors or perhaps a minor response that will hold for some period of time.
One final question about new agents before we get to your cases. Anti-angiogenics, obviously bevacizumab is very much a part of clinical practice. There are a bunch of other ones. I was really shocked at the ASCO GI meetings when Charlie Fuchs and Dana-Farber presented data on ramucirumab, an antibody to the VEGF receptor by itself in gastric cancer, and they showed some activity. What do we know about ramucirumab? What about some of the TKIs like BIBF-1120? Have you ever heard of fosprotubulin trimethamine?
Well, yeah, let me take on the first two first. You know, so with angiogenesis inhibitors in lung cancer, of course, we had the original results with bevacizumab where it prolonged survival by a little bit more than 2 months. Since that time, we've had a large number of TKIs that have come in, and many of those have prolonged progression-free survival, but not ended up prolonging overall survival. For example, vendetinib, a dual VEGF-EGFR inhibitor, sidirinib, and a number of different other TKIs. So they all clearly have activity, but not enough thus far to prolong overall survival. Now, ramucirumab is a monoclonal antibody that instead of targeting VEGF ligand the way that bevacizumab does, it targets the VEGF receptor 2. And we think that this receptor is the key driver for angiogenesis. We've also found recently that this is not only a driver of angiogenesis, but VEGF receptor 2 is often on tumor cells themselves. So it may be a target in certain lung cancers as well, a tumor-derived target. Now, why would you want to target the receptor instead of the ligand? Well, there's a couple of different ligands that can bind to VEGF receptor 2. So it may be the case that if you block VEGF, these other VEGF ligands may get upregulated and still activate VEGF receptor 2, even if you've got VEGF blocked. Whereas if you block the receptor itself, it may not matter which ligands are upregulated. So that's at least the theoretical advantage of blocking VEGF receptor 2. As you pointed out, there's been very exciting activity seen for the drug in gastric cancer. And based on that, we may be seeing this become a part of the standard treatment for gastric cancer. Now, there's phase 3 studies happening in lung cancer now for the drug. And we're eagerly awaiting results of this to see if this really does add something different than targeting VEGF by itself. And there's reasons to be hopeful about that. Now, ramucirumab is an example of how we might target the VEGF pathway better. But one thing that's clear is we need to move beyond VEGF. There's a lot of different factors that drive angiogenesis besides VEGF. One of the most important ones looks like the FGF family, for fibroblast growth factor family. So there's a number of different ligands. The common ones we look at are acidic FGF and basic FGF. And they bind to 4 main receptors that we look at, FGFR 1, 2, 3, and 4. FGFR2 is the main one we think about on tumor vasculature. FGFR1 is one that's often amplified in squamous cell carcinomas of the lung, in up to 20% of them. So targeting the FGFR pathway may have benefits for inhibiting angiogenesis, but also for targeting certain tumor cell populations. Now, out of the drugs that are coming along, the furthest along is BIBF-1120, and this is also known as nintedanib. And nintedanib has now gone through two randomized phase 3 studies. One of them is in combination with pemetrexed. The other one is in combination with docetaxel. And we're going to be hearing detailed results from those in the upcoming year. But the exciting thing about this drug is it not only blocks the VEGF receptor pathways, but it also blocks multiple FGF receptors and a couple of other targets like PDGF receptor and RET as well. So there's reasons to be hopeful that either by targeting the VEGF pathway more effectively or by targeting the VEGF pathway and some of these other pathways, like either MET or FGF receptor pathway, that we may make anti-angiogenic therapy more effective.
Let's do some of your cases. Maybe we can start out with your 66-year-old non-smoking patient.
So this gentleman, he's a 66-year-old Scandinavian engineer in the oil industry. We have a lot of them there in Houston, who presented initially with a stage 1B lung cancer. It was about 4.5 centimeters. He underwent resection. He was a lifetime non-smoker, had some minor chemical exposures. And after resection, he was found to be node negative, but he had EGFR mutations. Now, the interesting thing, he didn't have a single common EGFR mutation, like an L858R or an exon 19 deletion. He actually had two separate mutations, an E709A and a G719C. So now after this was resected, we had the question of what to do as adjuvant therapy. Now we commonly have the problem of what to do in the case of EGFR mutant lung cancer when it has a common mutation and what to give in adjuvant therapy in that setting. But this had the added complication that it actually had two separate uncommon mutations.
So I know there's a website you can go to and figure out which ones are more responsive to erlotinib. What do we know about these mutations and TKIs?
Well, so the data that's out there isn't a lot of clinical data about these. The G719C is known to be less responsive to erlotinib, both in the laboratory setting and a little bit of data that's assembled out there suggests that it's one that's less responsive. I'm not aware of data about the other one, the E709A. That's a very uncommon mutation. And, you know, from the large Lux Lung study, this was with the drug afatinib, which has a little different profile and is an irreversible inhibitor. But it seemed that the activity of the drug was a little bit less in these uncommon mutations, although they didn't have enough of each of the separate ones to really say which ones were highly sensitive and which ones weren't.
Well, in any event, it's a great teaching case because it brings up a couple of issues, which is, first of all, adjuvant chemotherapy, indications for it, 1B, choice of adjuvant chemotherapy. And then, even though this is kind of an unusual EGFR mutation, you know, the common question, probably the most common question we get from oncologists is, you know, do you consider an EGFR TKI in somebody with a mutation? You know, as you say, usually the more common ones. But what do we know about the information on both of those issues? And what'd you do with him? And what do you do in your practice?
Yeah, so this is something we're still grappling with. And I think the first answer is we don't have a definitive answer what to do with this group yet. There's a couple of studies going on. One of them is the RADIANT study, investigating whether adjuvant erlotinib offers benefit. The data so far about using EGFR TKIs in the adjuvant setting for mutant patients is mixed. So there was a study from the National Cancer Institute of Canada, the NCIC, in which they gave adjuvant gefitinib instead of erlotinib, but we know they have a similar spectrum, in patients that underwent resected lung cancer. Now, the subset that had EGFR mutations here was not very large, and they only gave the drug for roughly 6 months on the average, and the study was terminated early, so there are some caveats. But the surprising result of that was that patients who had EGFR mutations did not appear to benefit from getting treatment with adjuvant gefitinib in that study. In fact, the trend was in the opposite direction. They appeared to be doing a little bit worse. You know, and coupling this with the fact that there was an earlier SWOG study where there was chemo radiation and then they got gefitinib afterwards, and there they did substantially worse. This was the SWOG 0023 study. So this really opened my eyes to the possibility that not only may these patients not benefit, but it's conceivable that an EGFR TKI could do harm in the adjuvant setting. And that gave me a lot of pause. And I'll just make one other comment. Now, one of the other issues, this gentleman had a stage 1B lung cancer, and we know there's equivocal data about the benefit of adjuvant therapy for stage 1B lung cancers. We have some studies like JBR10 that support the use of adjuvant therapy for 1B lung cancers, and that was with the older regimen of cisplatin and vinorelbine. But one of the interesting findings from the CalGB 9633 study, this was specifically in patients with 1B non-small cell lung cancer, was that in the overall population, there wasn't a benefit for carboplatin and paclitaxel, but for tumors greater than 4 centimeters, there was a benefit. So some of us will look at stage 1Bs and try to take into account, first of all, is the patient in good shape? Do they have a good performance status? Are they on the younger side? And secondly, how large is their tumor? So in this case, his tumor is 4.5 centimeters. So take into account that he was a very healthy 66-year-old with not a lot of comorbidities and his tumor was greater than 4 centimeters, we decided to proceed with chemotherapy. Now, which chemotherapy to use is always a topic of debate. Most of the historical studies have used cisplatin and vinorelbine, and that has been around the longest. But we've got a lot of data now supporting the fact that modern regimens like docetaxel and cisplatin or pemetrexed and cisplatin may be more effective and are certainly better tolerated. So based on that and the fact that he had a well-differentiated adenocarcinoma, we ended up giving cisplatin and pemetrexed as adjuvant therapy for 4 cycles.
How did he do while he received the adjuvant chemo?
So he tolerated the adjuvant therapy without any significant problems. He was a hiker. He was frequently traveling to Europe. And, you know, he had perhaps 1 cycle where he was compromised in his ability to do his normal activities. But other than that, was able to carry about with his business without a significant problem.
Any comments? I noticed you put some slides in there from the so-called TREAT study. Can you talk about what they looked at and what you think it meant?
Yeah. So the TREAT study is very interesting. And one of the points when I was talking about which adjuvant chemotherapy to use, one of the issues we face is that adjuvant studies take a very long time to complete. And we have the historical studies that either used a mixture of different adjuvant chemotherapies or in some cases just cisplatin and vinorelbine or carboplatin and paclitaxel. But we don't have, it's very hard now to do an adjuvant study where you're testing which chemotherapy is the best. Now, in the TREAT study, they looked at cisplatin, vinorelbine, and cisplatin and pemetrexed. It wasn't a large enough study to say whether one was significantly better than the other in terms of outcomes. But what the study did establish unequivocally was cisplatin and pemetrexed was much better tolerated than cisplatin and vinorelbine. You could give a much better dose intensity. And at least the bits of clinical data we've seen so far suggest that it may be more effective, which would be consistent with our clinical experience. So this is enough data for me to, coupled with what we know about the activity of the drugs in the metastatic setting, to now use cisplatin and pemetrexed for my adenocarcinomas for whom I'm giving adjuvant chemotherapy. So I really don't use cisplatin and vinorelbine anymore in the adjuvant setting. In the metastatic setting, it's been shown that cisplatin and docetaxel is superior to cisplatin and vinorelbine. That was the TAX 326 study. So I essentially don't use the cisplatin and vinorelbine anymore. For non-squams, I use pemetrexed. For squams, I use cisplatin and docetaxel or cisplatin and gemcitabine.
And certainly that's a pretty common statement that we hear from investigators, although I'm not sure in practice it seems like there's still a lot of cisvinorelbine used.
Yeah, and you know, one can defend it by saying it's the one that's most studied, and that's true. But I think if you take the TREAT study and the TAX 326 study in our common practice, I think you can infer that it's not only a more toxic regimen, but it looks like it's a less active regimen as well.
So one more case I want to ask you about is your 50-year-old professor who presents with a malignant effusion with a lung adenocarcinoma. And I was amazingly just interviewing Matt Ellis on breast cancer, and he presented a 55-year-old woman with breast cancer that had a HER2 mutation, and he had just started her on lapatinib, although I think it really, I'm not sure that it actually helped her, but he's got a trial looking at neratinib, and we were talking about how the same thing's been seen in lung cancer, and here you've got a case of a patient who had it. What happened with this lady?
So she's a 50-year-old woman. She's a professor of literature and does photography and journalism, just a real interesting and dynamic woman who was getting a little more short of breath, and she was eventually diagnosed with well-differentiated adenocarcinoma. She was a lifetime non-smoker and very active and athletic. And she was found to be EGFR mutant negative and ALK fusion negative. And so she was sent to us for further evaluation. Now, just recently, we've started much more comprehensive profiling, particularly for our non-smokers who do not have EGFR and ALK. And so we're running a 46-gene panel that includes a number of other potential mutations, and we're running ROS1 fusions routinely in patients also. And this is using a next-generation sequencing platform at MD Anderson. And, you know, one of the things we've learned is that there's a lot of different mutations that we were just not catching before, particularly in the set of EGFR mutant negative, ALK mutant negative adenocarcinomas. And so this is one of the early ones. In fact, in the same week, we had two patients who came out and had HER2 mutations. Now, in this case, it was a G776V. And if you look at the results of the Lung Cancer Mutation Consortium, which is a consortium or a network of different investigators across the country who are doing profiling of lung cancers for these common mutations, HER2 mutations happen between 1 and 2% of patients. And they have a profile just like what EGFR mutants would look like. Now, we have the interesting problem is that we have very good drugs that can target the HER2 pathway. From breast cancer, of course, we have not only trastuzumab, but we also have lapatinib. Lapatinib, of course, being a TKI and trastuzumab being a monoclonal antibody. Now, we wrote her a prescription for lapatinib in collaboration with her primary oncologist locally, and it immediately got rejected. They said, this is a drug approved for breast cancer. It's not approved for lung cancer. And so we showed the results with HER2, and they said, well, we don't see anything out there about HER2 mutations in lung cancer, and so we're not approving this drug that's $6,000 a month or whatever the cost was in that range. So then we sent our HER2 FISH test with the hopes that it would be HER2 amplified, in which case we may be able to get trastuzumab approved. And it turned out to not be HER2 amplified. Now, I think the biggest experience for this has been presented by Mark Criss from Memorial Sloan Kettering. And what he's presented publicly is that there's very little overlap between the HER2 mutations and HER2 amplified subsets. And at least preclinically so far, the data suggests that these may be sensitive to TKIs, but may not be as sensitive to the antibodies.
Yeah, and I guess that's why Matt was interested in neratinib, and also that he put this lady on lapatinib too. I couldn't figure out from him, but I kind of get the feeling that whether it's lung or breast cancer, that we actually don't really know if there's ever been any responses observed, you know, to anti-HER therapy.
Yeah, so lapatinib, there isn't a literature yet on responses to this. Now, Mark Criss presented some data with dacomitinib, which is an EGFR HER2, in fact, a pan-HER inhibitor that actually shows very promising results in lung cancer and is effective against EGFR mutations as well. And from the data he showed, there's clearly single-agent responses to dacomitinib, and there's an ongoing trial now specifically for dacomitinib in HER2 mutant lung cancers.
That's interesting.
Yeah, so that would be one possibility. So with this patient, so we weren't able to get lapatinib initially, and so we started with pemetrexed, carboplatin, and bevacizumab. She had a very nice initial response and then has sort of stabilized and has just started maintenance therapy with pemetrexed and bevacizumab. And, you know, so far she's got stable disease. Her responses have sort of leveled out. In fact, there's a question of whether there's a little bit of increase recently. 2 days ago, the insurance company approved lapatinib. We had been sending them literature and case studies and so forth, and the rationale for this. And so we're actually ready to start this person on lapatinib in the upcoming week. So, you know, shortly we hope to be able to present results with that. Now, the same week we had a second patient who had a HER2 mutation in the same location and also had concurrently a couple of other mutations, a P53 mutation, and so forth. And in that case, the family was able to pay for lapatinib. And so that was about 2 months ago. Very shortly, we'll have the results of the restaging studies to see if there's been responses. So I think this is an emerging area to keep an eye on about how to treat this. And this is a small population, you know, 1% to 2%. But if you add that up, you know, it's about half the size of ALK mutations that we're treating routinely now. And I think the key issue with this group is that it's a population that hasn't been detected routinely because our routine screening tests have not been detecting HER2 mutations. But as more groups move to multiplex mutational profiling, I think we're going to see more and more of these cases.
Do we know the Cancer Genome Project or ATLAS data on adenocarcinoma yet, or do you know it?
Yeah, we do know it, and there have been parts of that have been, you know, presented already. And the data from the TCGA is consistent with what we've seen from the Lung Cancer Mutation Consortium, which is out of driver mutations, EGFR mutation is the most common targetable one right now.
Did they see the HER2 mutations?
Yeah, they did. And on the same order of magnitude in the range of 1% to 2% and with the same spectrum. Now, I should say both ALK and HER2 appear to be slightly underrepresented as compared to what we seem to be getting in the metastatic population. The TCGA was an analysis primarily of resected lung cancers, of early stage lung cancers. And so there are some reasons to believe that the distribution we see in the metastatic setting may be different than the surgical distribution because often patients with ALK or EGFR mutations or HER2 mutations present with metastatic disease. They're often younger, healthier, non-smokers, less likely to get screening studies or intensive workup, and more likely to have a diffuse, well-differentiated adenocarcinoma presentation. So that's why the surgical data probably underrepresents the frequency of these mutations that are happening in non-smokers. But with that said, the mutations are certainly detected in the TCGA.
Yeah, actually, Matt Ellis made the exact same point about breast cancer. And I guess the thought that these are kind of more aggressive tumors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in our case, it may not be that they're necessarily more aggressive, but it may be that they're occurring in a population where lung cancer is less likely to get detected.
Wow.
And they're more likely to be multifocal, I think may be the case.
Interesting. One final question. I see that this lady got carbo, PEM, and BEV, as you said, and then BEV, PEM maintenance, which she's on right now. Is that your usual approach to patients with wild-type tumors with metastatic disease?
Yeah, that, of course, is a topic of hot debate, you know, because we now have some data comparing the ECOG 4599 regimen, or what we call sometimes the Sandler regimen, of carboplatin, paclitaxel, and bevacizumab, which, of course, doesn't have chemotherapy in the maintenance setting. It just has bevacizumab in the maintenance setting, versus the results of what we call the Patel regimen, the carboplatin, pemetrexed, and bevacizumab, followed by pemetrexed and bevacizumab maintenance therapy. And the overall survival is not significantly different between those two groups. And so from that study, there's different ways to interpret it. You know, progression-free survival did appear to favor, although not significantly, the carboplatin, pemetrexed, and bevacizumab arm. And if you looked at patients during the maintenance phase, it appeared they were less likely to progress on pemetrexed and bevacizumab, but nonetheless, there wasn't a significant improvement in overall survival seen. You know, my practice has been for patients who have a very good performance status and would like to be aggressive and for whom their disease is causing symptoms where I feel that slowing progression-free survival may help them feel better, I'm more likely to use pemetrexed and bevacizumab in the maintenance setting for them. Whereas people that are a bit beaten up by initial induction treatment, more likely to use either bevacizumab maintenance therapy or pemetrexed maintenance therapy. Now, if you use bevacizumab maintenance therapy and they begin to then have some evidence of progression, you know, sometimes in my practice, I'll add back pemetrexed or switch to pemetrexed maintenance there as well, even though they had received pemetrexed initially as induction, because there's still the possibility that it may offer benefit in the maintenance setting. So there is the ECOG 5508 study that's going to attempt to definitively answer that question. And there, they're going to be testing maintenance therapy with either bevacizumab, pemetrexed, or bevacizumab plus pemetrexed to see which is best. But in the absence of that study, I really base it on how aggressive the patient would like to be in their performance status. And I reserve pemetrexed and bevacizumab maintenance specifically for younger patients with a better performance status who want to be more aggressive.